You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com. Have you ever wondered what it's like inside a screenwriter's mind? In this podcast, we explore how successful screenwriters tackle structure, plot, character, dialogue, and the film business. Get ready to go down the rabbit hole of story as we pull the best interviews from the archives of the IFH Podcast Network. Let's travel inside the screenwriter's mind. This episode originally aired on the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie is going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. So guys, I am super excited for today's episode. We have the creator and writer of Waterworld, considered one of the biggest flops in Hollywood history. It was a punchline in Hollywood for years because it was the biggest movie budget ever for about 5 minutes until Titanic showed up a year or two later. But the budget ballooned from $100 million to $175 million back in 1995. It was released, but 94 or so when they were shooting this. And no one had ever seen anything like that. They thought it was going to be a complete train wreck. And it was supposed to be a bomb. It starred Kevin Costner, which arguably was the biggest movie star in the world at the time. And it was basically Mad Max on the water. That's what Waterworld is Mad Max on the water. And I remember watching that film, and I actually loved it. I thought it was a lot of fun. It was directed by Kevin Reynolds, who directed Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which we just came off of with Kevin Costner. And Kevin Costner was at the peak of his powers during that time. He had already directed Dances with Wolves, won an Oscar, and was honestly the biggest movie star in the world. So poor Peter, who wrote this script, this was his first script. This was his first big sale, and it was a fairly big sale for him. He got a deal out of it. There was a bidding war. It was pretty amazing. And I wanted to talk to Peter about what it was like being in the middle of a storm like that, because that's a unique scenario for a screenwriter to be in, to be considered one of the biggest flops in Hollywood history. But you will understand that the script that he wrote has very little left from it after it was rewritten and beaten the hell up, you know, by at least another 20 writers, and the script really just got grinded up by the Hollywood machine. So we're going to get into all of that in this conversation, but we're also going to talk about how Waterworld became one of the most profitable IPs that Universal Studios owns to this day. They make hundreds of millions of dollars because of Waterworld, and we will get into how that happened and how Peter fought to get a piece of that as a writer and set an amazing precedent for all writers in the Writers Guild to get paid off of their screenplays when it's not just the exploitation of the screenplay itself as a movie. There's so much to dig into this episode. I cannot wait for you guys to listen. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Peter Rader. I'd like to welcome to the show Peter Rader, man. How are you doing, Peter?
I am great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, man. Thank you so much for coming on the show. You've been on my other shows as a documentarian, as a producer, as a self-distribution guru. And it's so odd because when I was so excited to meet you, and we had that lunch that day in that ridiculously expensive Indian restaurant. I still never forgot that. I'm like, how much is the buffet? But we were sitting there, and I was so excited about the movie you did with called Awake about Yogananda that I really never realized that you were the writer of Waterworld. Only like months or maybe even a year later, I was doing like, I think we're going to do another interview. And I was like, oh, let me just check out what else he's done. And I was like, oh my God, you wrote Waterworld. I'm like, I can't believe. And I'm a fan of the movie. I actually loved the movie when it came out. And I'm like, oh, I got to get him on the show. So thank you so much for coming on the show to talk all things Waterworld and your experience writing it and dealing with it and all the stuff that came out of it.
So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I have existed on both two extremes of the entertainment business. I've written, you know, gigantic movies for the Hollywood studios, and I've also, you know, produced indie documentaries about a spiritual master. So you can't get more different than those two. I've got stories to tell.
So, all right. So for everyone listening, how did you get into the business as a writer?
So I had a light bulb go off in college. I took a film production course and I was like, this is it. Got it. This is it. This is my life. I'm making movies. I'm telling stories. I loved it. I loved the technology. I loved, you know, the whole idea of the narrative and you know, just mythological archetypes and telling epic stories, all of that. Got the bug. I thought I was on a directing track. That's I was like, I'm going to direct. I'm going to be a director because I just loved, you know, just that whole thing, just controlling the whole process, particularly post-production. Got to Hollywood, moved out here, and did some independent, you know, like music videos, did a couple of music videos as a director, you know, and was hustling and actually did a couple of low-budget features. I did a gothic horror movie called Grandmother's House, which was great, and another genre movie called Hired to Kill, which was Dirty Dozen with women.
Nice.
Both were the same producer. But it was kind of like this thankless thing where it wasn't kind of getting me to the kind of stories that I wanted to tell. And meanwhile, sort of on the side, I was kind of doing some writing. I never saw myself as a writer. That was so interesting. It actually took me years to realize, you know, I'm a writer. Even after Waterworld, I didn't realize I was a writer. But I had developed this story. And interestingly, the genesis of the story did come out of the low-budget world. Mm-hmm. Up until that point, in my early and mid-20s, I was thinking, what can I do for no money? Like, what can I do in one location on a weekend? You know, like every young filmmaker is thinking, like, what can I contain, small, small, small. And this one guy invited me in for a meeting. He worked for Roger Corman. His name was Brad Crevoy. Mm-hmm. And he actually went on to produce a bunch of the Farrelly brother movies, you know, pretty big producer. But at the time, he was kind of hustling and raising money for Roger Corman by any means necessary. So in this case, he said, okay, Peter, here's the deal. I've got some South African money. Okay. I got some South African investors and they want to make a Mad Max ripoff. If you write it, I'll let you direct it. Okay. So it was like, okay, I'm being asked two moral questions here.
It's one, a straight up Mad Max ripoff. Got it. Okay.
Yes. So am I willing to take the South African blood money? Okay. Because it was still the apartheid era.
You know? Oh, geez. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so there's that. And then second, was I willing to do a Mad Max ripoff? Okay. So unfortunately, the answer to the first question was yes. Mm-hmm. If it was going to get me my directing break, you know, whatever. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. Second question was I willing to write another one of these Mad Max ripoffs that were a dime a dozen that everyone was developing, that was, you know, everyone was bringing to MIPCOM and AFM. Here, I got this. I got gasoline blowing up in the desert. I got old beat up cars. I got machine guns. It was just completely oversaturated and boring. And it wasn't exciting to me. But I remember walking, in the marina here in L.A., and a bunch of us had like chartered a boat or wherever we're going to go out sailing, whatever. And I looked around and I was like, I got one of those light bulbs. It was like on water. Mad Max on water. That's how we redefine the genre. You know, happens all the time. It's like, you know, Star Wars is a Western in space. It's like you take something.
Die Hard on a boat. Die Hard in a building. Die Hard in a plane. Yeah.
Die Hard with a blind guy or whatever, yeah. You know. Change up one element and it becomes a completely different story. Because we are rehashing the same stories over and over again anyway. Mm-hmm. And Waterworld is a Western. I'll get to that in a second. But I did come up with that idea, which is let's set it on water, flooded planet. How cool would that be? Boats, jet skis, boom. So I went back to Brad and I said, okay, Brad, here, I got it. We're going to do Mad Max on water. And he looked at me, are you out of your freaking mind?
It's going to cost a fortune.
Yeah, a movie like that, literally, it's going to cost us $5 million. No.
$5 million.
Easy. You know, he wanted to spend like 50 grand.
Right.
100 times his budget. No. So he said no. And I said, I still like this idea. So I wrote it on spec. And I was so fearless. You know, when you're young and you don't know the rules and you don't know all the rules that you're breaking, that's a good time. That's a beautiful creative time. And I think I just cranked out a draft in 3 weeks. And then at the time, I knew no one. I knew no producers, no writer. No. My cousin was dating a writer who was working on a TV series. And I said, would you take a look at this? Would you read it? The guy read it and goes, he gave me a meh. You know, and I was like, a meh? Oh! It was a knife in the heart. So I said, okay, I'll put this on a shelf. I'm putting this on a shelf. And I went off and I pursued these other opportunities that I mentioned, the two low-budget movies, mm-hmm. Okay? In the second movie, I was so disillusioned. I was like, oh, my God, this is a path to nowhere. You know, do I really want to do these movies? And I opened the drawer. I dusted off the script and I said, this thing is not bad. I wrote it in 86. In 89, I took another look at it and I was like, this is not bad. I did a quick rewrite. By the way, I wrote the original draft on the original Macintosh computer, the, mm-hmm. the one, you know, the 1984.
Sure. Nice.
Anyway, dusted it off. I rewrote it on a slightly later version of the Mac, I think. And then it was one of these just Hollywood dream stories where, like, at that point I did know a few producers. I gave it to one. They were like, this is really good. Oh, my God, I'm going to give it to this guy. I got an agent. I got a lawyer. Before I knew it, it was handed to John Davis, you know, who's a big producer, who had a deal at Fox. His father ended up buying Fox later, but that's a separate story. His office was in the Die Hard building, you know, and he said, I know who's perfect for this, Larry Gordon. So he marched into Larry Gordon, and, you know, within 3 weeks, I had a deal, and it wasn't just one, you know, they bought this spec script, and then my crazy agent at the time, who was at ICM and then he moved to CIA, in the room said, you like this thing? You know what his next project is? I don't even want to talk about it, but you know, I want you to commit to two pictures. He got me a two-picture deal, sight unseen, on a script that didn't even exist in my imagination. I had no
clue. Wow.
Shit. So and then began my baptism by fire, because I was so naive at the time that I didn't even realize that a writer could be fired. You know, I thought, I'm the writer.
It's my idea. What are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, development hell. It was just crazy. All the executives got in there. Everyone had an opinion. Everyone had a piss on the script. You know, get this idea, do this, darker, grittier, you know, blah, 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 more edgy, more Mad Max, more this, you know. And I ended up doing 7 drafts. You know, some new ideas came into it that were good, but mostly it was like horizontal changes or actually kind of a diminishing of the, you know, the sort of energy and
a watering down, if you will, no pun intended.
It was a watering down. And I'll take a sip of water to remember. And then, you know, there was a series of writers that came on. So when Kevin Reynolds and Kevin Costner came aboard, I had one creative conversation with Kevin Reynolds. And then he basically said, look, I think it needs a new voice. You know, we're going to bring in another writer. And of course, you know, Kevin Costner had someone in mind. They brought in, you know, whoever. I don't remember the sequence exactly, writers. But there were 5 writers who actually participated in the arbitration. There was one writer, Joss Whedon, worked on it without any credit or whatever. He was like a script doctor, literally on set. But ultimately, there were 20 drafts. And, you know, the thing was arbitrated. And, you know, I got, of course, first position credit, and I shared with David Tuohy, who, you know, ended up doing, some good work on the piece.
Now, do you have the original script still, like your version of it?
I do have
it. Is it available anywhere for anybody to read?
It might even be on the web. People have seen it. It's been the subject of various – I mean, we're probably going to get into this, but it was – we did various arbitrations at one point. We had to find the story of origin and trace it back. And here's – this is the quintessential Hollywood story. 3 months before production – so I sold the script in 1990. They went into production in 94, and in 95 – the movie came out, and in fact, we're celebrating the 25th anniversary this year. Mm-hmm. 3 months before production in 1994, Chuck Gordon, Larry's brother, who was also a producer on the movie, took me out to lunch just to kind of let me know what was going on and stuff and, you know, connect. And he said to me, you know, Peter, you know, the deal is that we still don't have a script that's as good as your original spec script. I was like, you've got to be kidding. Shoot the original. Exactly. Thank you. Shoot the original. And he said, too late. The train has left the station. We've built the sets. We've committed to producing this other script. And even though it's not as good as your original, it loses the energy. When you write it into the ground, there's something about, you know, original drafts.
Well, let me ask you a question, because how old were you when this happened?
Let's see. I was around 27, I think.
All right, so that's fairly young to be thrown into the deep end of the pool here, because you're at this point playing at the upper echelons of Hollywood, and you're playing with some really big players of the day. So when someone, you know, I want writers listening to understand that it's not always the best script that gets made. It's just not. There's politics, ego, money. There's so many things that get thrown into the mix, and that he took you out to lunch and said, hey, I wish we never got anything as good as your original script. That's a great definition of Hollywood, isn't it? Yeah. Like, it's like, oh, we had something really good. We watered it down to appease all of the egos and all of the politics involved. And now we're just, man, wish we could just go back to what we originally bought. Now, unless you are Joss Whedon, Christopher Nolan, Ian Tarantino, Sorkin, you know, very established screenwriters. And even they, depending, not Tarantino as much, but maybe even they still have to deal with some of this stuff. They would have had the juice to push back a bit. You had no juice because you were just like happy. You were happy to be there.
Yeah. And also, this goes to another question that is really a point to make, which is in the Hollywood structure, you're assigning your copyright. You give away your copyright.
They buy
you out, which is unlike Europe, you know, and unlike playwrights, you know. In Europe, writers retain their copyrights and they give a license, an extended license, you know, to the producer. And, you know, playwrights control their material on Broadway. They own the copyright. In, you know, Hollywood, the pact with the devil, the money is big, the upside is big, you know, there's fame, fortune, all these things, but you are giving away your copyright, which means they can do whatever they want with the material. And this is going to tie into a conversation that I hope we get to, which is this whole idea of separated rights, which is there are certain rights that the writer retains, mm-hmm. even in the Writers Guild contract, you know, such as novelization. You have the right to turn your work into a novel. Dramatic stage rights. You have the right to adapt your work into a play version of the script.
Right.
But other than that, they have free reign.
So, okay. So you're a few months away from production. You've been, obviously, there's been a barrage of writers on board at this point in the game. And now you've got Kevin, who at that point was already an Oscar winning director. And write. I'm not sure if he didn't write dances, right?
No. Yes, but he's not directing.
No, I know. You know, Kevin. No, Kevin Reynolds is directing. Yeah, I know. But he still was a Oscar winning. Yeah, he was. He was it in the 90s. It was
of Prince of Thieves. He was coming off of a hit movie, Prince of Thieves, the Robin Hood movie. So
right. He was and Dances with Wolves before that, and Field of Dreams and all the stuff that he'd been doing during that time. He was in the heyday of a thing. So Kevin, from what I understand, I've spoken to a few people who worked with him before, after, and during that time. He pretty much controlled the show. Like whatever Kevin wants, Kevin gets. So if he wants a new writer to come on board, guess what, everybody? That new writer is coming on board. He wielded a lot of power. And that's also the height of the movie star. The movie star with the movie star power.
Yep.
Not as much today. There are still obviously movie stars, but not, you know. Before, you could literally put Kevin Costner reading a back of a cereal box and you got 20 million opening.
Yep.
You know. Okay. I mean, essentially, that's the way it worked back then. So how are you? So the movie gets started, and they're producing it. And I mean, I'm assuming you went on set.
I did.
So okay, how was? Because the stories are legendary of how. I mean, you're shooting on water, that like is rough. It's a rough. You're working in the elements. It wasn't a tank for the most part, if I'm not mistaken, right?
No, it was no tank at all. In fact, here's the truth. I understand that Kevin Reynolds. In pre-production, decided to call the one guy who could give you a lot of advice about how to shoot on water. He called Spielberg and he said, "Hey, Steven, here's the deal. I'm doing Waterworld. We're doing it on water. You know, do you have any advice for me?" Spielberg said unequivocally, "Do not shoot on fucking water. You know, you're going to get the vistas, set out second unit, get your big shots on water, you know, whatever, your drones, your helicopters." We didn't have drones back then, but do everything on a tank, everything in a tank or, you know, in a stage, everything, everything, everything. And Kevin Reynolds decided to disagree with Spielberg. And it just was a bizarre decision, you know, but I understand it. I want to defend Kevin Reynolds and Costner. I'm sure Costner was part of that decision. They wanted the verisimilitude. They wanted that gritty, no denying it. We are out in the frickin' middle of nowhere, water field. And they did get that. They did that. This is godforsaken, flooded planet, city, you know.
Right.
It's out in the middle of nowhere. But the cost of that, you know, the price of that was that, you know, they went wildly over budget. And also there's a certain ugliness to the movie because – you know, the first shot of the day always ended up being like a 11 o'clock or noonday sun, even though their call was like 6 a.m. or 5:30. By the time they got all the freaking boats out there, the picture boat, the catering boat, the prop boat, you know, you're looking at 11 and then you've got this ugly sun. So they really ended up getting like 5 or 6 setups a day. And, you know, then the one beauty shot, like as the sun ball was setting in the thing, they would get that one beauty shot. And that was it. That was their day, you know.
There was a storm that hit that, right, too?
Yeah, just before production. So here I'm going to set up my visit to the set. So about 3 weeks into production, I show up on set and so excited. You know, this is my first feature. I mean, there was already a little bit of negative press, you know, going around. But, you know, I didn't care. Press is press. It was so exciting.
Sure.
Huge movie. You know, and I flew to Hawaii where they were shooting Big Island off the West Coast. And I show up and I'm getting this energy like from the crew, like everyone is like glaring at me. I'm like, why are they glaring at me? And everyone was like, that's the fucking writer. You know,
that's the guy who put us through this hell.
Exactly. That's what it was, you know. And
that's amazing.
You know, I suddenly realized that, you know, here I am arriving 3 weeks into production. And they're like 2.5 weeks late. They're already – all they got was like 2 or 3 days of shooting, you know, 3 weeks in. And everyone saw the writing on the wall. It was a disaster. A couple of weeks before production, that enormous set, that floating set that they had built, sank. It sank. And they had to rebuild it from scratch.
Yeah, that's the Dennis Hopper like fort thing.
Yeah. No, not the Dennis Hopper thing. The good guys. The eight.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, that thing sank, and you know, it was just a little bit of a disaster. So in that way.
So just for everybody listening, if you're doing a movie and on day one you're a page behind, you're already in trouble. You got to pick that up. If you're 2.5 weeks in, and you've got 3 day shoot or 2.5 days of actual shooting.
3 weeks in, they had gotten 3 days of shooting.
Correct. Behind them. This is an absolute disaster that you can pull your way out of it. It would be a miracle. And the only thing that can fix that is money. That's that. There's no catching up. It's just a money hose. And at the time, what was the starting budget of the film, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm going to guess. You know, there was one point at which we were actually looking at another director. This, I guess he was Norwegian. His name was Niels Gaup. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, a talented indie guy, but, you know, he was not this was where they were thinking, you know, we're going to make this thing for $60 million or something. Well, you know, we'll really contain it. By the time we got, you know, movie stars in and stuff, it was up there. It was, you know, pushing whatever, 80, 90. Ultimately, I think the budget was 175, which made it the most expensive movie of all time for 5 minutes, because it was immediately eclipsed by like 30 other movies, including that, the Batman one with Schwarzenegger and Clooney and all.
Oh, Batman
guys.
And like, Robin, which was just, oh.
Yeah. The above the line alone was like $60 million on that, you know?
Right.
So it was like, you know, short lived record for the most expensive movie of all time. But, you know, that's not the only reason it became a punching bag. It also coincided with, you know, as you said, Costner himself was, you know, wielding this enormous power, and yet he was very vulnerable. His marriage was falling apart. There was some scandal involving, you know, some affair that he had in Hawaii, and the press just decided, let's go to town. Like, here's a good story. You know, they're over budget, you know, heaven, you know, what they call it, Kevin's Gate for a while.
Kevin's Gate instead of Heaven's Gate. Yeah.
Fish Star. Oh, you know, this is great. This is a story. And then that story turned out to be a myth, you know, and we're going to get to that, which is ultimately, you know, that water.
The legacy of it. All right. So you're going on set. So everyone hates you. What else happened on that day when you were there?
I, you know, went out on the boat and hung out with Costner, and we chatted, and Hopper, I think, was in the scene, or maybe I saw him earlier or whatever. And it was all very pleasant, you know, and it was exciting for me. But, you know, ultimately it was, you know, it was a mixed blessing. On the one hand, I was super pumped and super excited. And also I was heartsick. I was heartsick because I was realizing that the essence of what I had written was not really in there. You know, Chuck Gordon had told me as much, but I was also feeling it. I was sensing it. You know, they had made a series of choices that were really kind of taking the heart out of the movie a little bit and just making it kind of, you know, edgy in kind of the wrong way, in my opinion. So it was like, okay, you know. I stayed there for a week. I went to the set a couple times, and then I went home.
So so you're 27 or around that age, and you're walking on, at the time, the most expensive movie ever made, and it's your script. I mean, that has to be a thrill. I mean, regardless of the punching bag, regardless of the press, I would be so excited. And it's just such a massive film, like the size of it. I mean, on the water, and it was a fairly epic film to be shot.
It was. You know, I have to say that the I think two moments in that story were bigger than that. When I actually sold that script, you mm-hmm. know, spec script, and there was like a little bit of a bidding war and everything, and I was part of that, you know, whole spec script thing. I mean, that moment for me was like, oh, I made it. You know, this is great. In my dream, you know. And I remember that Christmas, it was just before Christmas in 89, my father was coming out to visit, you know. I just ended up renting like a limo and picking him up there with a limo and champagne and stuff. It was a lot of fun. I mean, I was 27, you know. I was so young. And so unprepared for that voyage, you know, and the set moment, you know, had this kind of bittersweet feeling to it. And then ultimately, you know, then finally the third moment was the premiere, you know, this huge Hollywood premiere at the Man's Chinese. And, you know, again, another limo and, you know, this whole thing. And, you know, I brought like 20 friends, and that was really exciting. And again, it was a mixed feeling there. The first part of it was super exciting. Kevin Reynolds' idea to deconstruct the Universal logo. Here you have the Universal logo, the globe, and the, you know, letters wrapping around, and then they float away, and you see the globe, and you see the continents disappearing. Mm-hmm. You end up zooming in on the world, and it's all water, and then whoosh, you come in on Kevin's, you know, on the trimaran. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, that is a great moment. Like, they nailed it. And then, you know, the first scene of the movie was the first scene of every draft that was written, you know, which never changed. It was my scene, which is he pisses, puts it into a contraption, filters it, and he drinks his own urine.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That tells you visually, sets up the whole movie without having to say any words. You know,
which so is I really that. Which is and I want to just jump on that for a second, because as opposed to a lot of writers will write, because you needed to establish what was going on in a very quick and efficient way. I can't think of another way that you could have done it better. Obviously, because after 400 writers or however many people wrote on it, they didn't change that because it was so well constructed. Because without one word, you're right. You know, oh, this is a water world. There's no land, and fresh water seems to be an issue.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting. A friend of my son's goes to USC Film School and was taking a sort of intro screenwriting class, and I forgot the professor's name, but you know, basically he was talking about, you know, grabbing the audience in the first 5 minutes and setting up the scenes, and he said, who here has seen, knows the opening of Waterworld? He actually used Waterworld as a case study. And of course, no one raised their hand, but this one kid, my son's friend, knew the film and said, I do. And it was that scene, that idea of just, you know, the economy of really, you know, setting up the whole thing and just, you know, visually.
So the movie comes out and it's already, I mean, you know, like I've had other writers and creators on that have been in like cultural zeitgeist moments. Like we had the creators of Blair Witch, which was like a complete, I mean, I had to ask him, like, how did it feel being in the center of that storm? I have to ask you the same question. The negativity, it was a punchline. Waterworld was a punchline for a long time of being a flop and like, oh my God. And it was like an example of Hollywood excess and the powers of movie stars and all this stuff, which obviously, none of this was your fault, but you get some of that blame. Some of that energy goes to you. What was it like as a writer and as a human being to be caught up in that?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting, very intense, and amazing. It was amazing. I have to say that even the bad press was kind of exciting on some level for me, because as you said, it wasn't really my fault. You know, I created an idea and then it basically got taken over and, you know, a series of decisions were made that I had nothing to do with. And here we were. On the other hand, you know, it was being written about, you know, in every newspaper, every
around
country.
The world.
Everyone knew about that work, you know, that title. It became part of the zeitgeist. You know, it still is to this day. It has cult status. I still get residual checks. Substantial residual checks every quarter from that movie 25 years later, because it kind of struck a chord of some kind. I mean, I think part of it, of course, is, you know, the origin story, which is the flood myth. Every culture has a flood myth. And I was recently, someone was telling me, you know, what that potentially was caused by, which is, you know, there was a meteor strike potentially way back in the day, but it wasn't just one meteor, because it wouldn't have affected all these different continents. It was this huge rock that broke up and went bump, 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 bump. So it had a whole bunch of splashes and apparently, you know, wiped out a lot of cultures, and hence the, you know, the flood myth, you know, the Noah's Ark, and every civilization has this myth. And I think the combination of that idea, which is probably baked into our DNA, and also, this kind of obsession with post-apocalyptic movies, which everyone seems to have.
Well, and in today's world, not so much fiction anymore.
Exactly. In fact, I was invited to the United Nations to talk about Waterworld. We can talk about that if you're interested.
What? Please elaborate.
Okay. not long ago, around 6 months ago, I got a call out of the blue from a National Geographic journalist who was saying, I'm organizing a roundtable at the United Nations to discuss the feasibility of floating cities. In other words, we're dealing with two crises at the same time, simultaneously. Habitat loss, from rising oceans and increasing populations. What are we going to do with, like, for instance, Bangladesh? Like, the ocean rises 5 feet and that's millions of people displaced. But, what are we going to do with them? Is it possible to create floating cities that are actually self-sustaining and could, blah, blah, blah. So they brought in a whole team of architects, a rock star architect from Denmark and engineers and blah, blah, and they brought in a screenwriter, because basically the model that they created, the prototype model, looked exactly like the atoll, So here I was, talking to the Undersecretary General and a whole bunch of bigwigs at, about this idea. And, it makes perfect sense that they should involve screenwriters. I'm going to tell you one little other anecdote that might be interesting to your audience, which is I heard, in fact, I know some of the people that were part of this, that after 9/11, the National Security Agency brought in a bunch of – created a writer's room of Hollywood screenwriters and said, listen, we want you to tell us what's next, because 9/11 was not a failure of intelligence. We knew these guys. We knew they were going to flight school. It was a failure of imagination. We didn't make that leap of faith that they would weaponize airplanes. What do you got, you writers who think about this stuff all the time?
Right.
So it's like, writers have a place at that table, which is thinking about the most incredible, implausible ideas that could actually help us in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I still remember days after 9/11, like I when the plane would fly by, I would have literally have reactions, physical reactions to it. And what we're going through right now with Corona and the COVID crisis, I promise you that the hangover, even after a vaccine and after this kind of goes away, which could be years, there's going to be a hangover of a generation. Yeah. Of people who are going to be like, I don't want to go to a concert. and that's something I've talked about ad nauseum on my other podcast as well, which is, how many people are really going to want to go back to the movie theater all the time? I'll throw that out to you just out of curiosity. I want to go. I want to go see Tenet in a big screen. I want to go see the next big Marvel movie or a big event film in the big screen, an IMAX or something like that. But you got to balance it out. Like, is it worth the risk? And even a year from now, even 2 years from now, it's going to take a minute before you go back in, like any trauma.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the business has changed for sure. And we don't exactly know how, but, even in our world, we're distributing a movie online, a virtual distribution of a movie. We're, using whatever on, streaming technology and doing a whole thing and completely, rewriting the rules as we go along, because we have to figure it out.
Now, with all this, negative press that happened when Waterworld came around, how did the town treat you as a screenwriter? Because you were hot stuff for a minute, because there's a bidding war, you've got a two-picture deal. How did that play out?
So I was spared the, I got a lot of assignments after Waterworld. And unfortunately, they were all huge, epic sci-fi things that never got made. No one was going to do it again. But that's the thing. They said, you're the world creator. Let's create a world over here. Let's create a world over there. I did a whole bunch of them. And they ended up in development hell. And that's actually one of the things that informed my pivot to, to indie filmmaking and distribution, which is what I'm doing now with my wife. I met my wife. She was she said, let's go to the Sundance Film Festival, and I was like, I suddenly just got excited again, like I was in college about, making movies where you're actually making the movies, I joined her in the company and we've been doing a number of projects, ever since then. And it's hands on. It's like really fun, it's not the same money and there's trade offs and stuff, but you're always making choices between, the pact with the devil and your heart's truth and those things. So that's an ongoing thing. But I do think that the business has changed, and you know, it's up to us to sort of redefine how we're going to reengage.
Now, can we talk a little bit about the legacy of Waterworld? Because so many people think of it, you know, especially of a certain generation. That, I mean, kids nowadays, you know, unless they look it up, they weren't, you know, in this, it wasn't in the zeitgeist of them growing up, like it was with me, like it was with you, that we knew Waterworld, but it was considered a flop. Like, I remember when Ishtar, like nobody remembers Ishtar, but I remember Ishtar being like the punchline. And Heaven's Gate is a legendary punchline. And Titanic, by the way, just a couple years later, took the throne as like, this is going to suck. This is a complete disaster. This is not going to make any money whatsoever. It's 200 million plus. Who's this James Cameron think he is? Well, that worked out okay for James. What is the legacy of the actual numbers of the film? Because it was considered a flop, but the truth is different.
Yeah. I mean, everyone, the 25th anniversary, everyone is writing the story, which is, you know, Waterworld was so not a flop. In fact, I'll go on the record saying that Waterworld is one of the most profitable titles in the Universal catalog. And it all comes from the theme park exploitation. So what happened, you know, a couple years after the film came out was Universal Studios Hollywood had this Miami Vice stunt show, which was, you know, yeah. They had a water tank and, you know, boats and stuff. And they were like, no one's going to this stunt show. No one's going. Who cares about Miami Vice? We got to reinvent this or, you know, upgrade it. And we're like, Waterworld, let's do Waterworld. You know, so they suddenly created a Waterworld show. That show has been running at that park for, you know, 25 minus 2 years.
So yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it a ton of times. I love that part. I love that show.
Arena seats 2,500 people, and they have a dozen shows a day. And it park is open before COVID was 365 days a year. So you can do the math there. That's tens upon tens upon tens of millions, if not 100 million in that theme park. Then they opened one in Osaka and Singapore. And now they're opening one 2021, supposedly. Let's see what happens in Beijing. And in that in the Beijing Universal theme park, there's a Waterworld zone. Okay, it has its own zone.
It's a land, like a land,
like Jurassic, like Transformers, like a whole Harry Potter. You know, movies that have had franchises that have had 7-8 titles in them. You know, get their zones, and then Waterworld gets a zone. You know, why is that? It's because the demand, the interest, the fascination with Waterworld has no limits, and also because it's, you know, a splash zone or whatever. It's a fun zone for. You know,
it's a good brand. It's a good IP for Universal.
It's a fantastic brand. You know, I'm still getting the residual checks. And if you do the math on 4 theme parks, you know, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of millions of people have been exposed to this Waterworld idea. Now, the great thing about that is that the Writers Guild, right after that theme park was open, approached me and David Tuohy, the two credited writers, and said, you know what? No writer has ever been paid for a theme park exploitation of their work. But we think that we have a chance to argue that this constitutes a exploitation of the dramatic stage rights, which is one of those separated rights that a writer retains in a Writers Guild contract. So we're saying that the, you know, the Waterworld stunt show is basically a staged version of the show, a 20-minute version. It's verbatim dialogue. It's the same characters. It's the same story. And, you know, the Universal threw a ton of money and a ton of lawyers to fight us. Fight, 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 fight. And the smoking gun moment, this was brilliant, was we got a transcript of their, you know, of the stunt show or whatever, verbatim line transcript. And there was this block of dialogue, like 3 or 4 sentences in, I think, the Deacon, you know, the bad guy had the speech or whatever. It wasn't in our final scripts. It wasn't in any of the final movies, but it actually, that verbatim 3 sentences, paragraph of dialogue appeared in a script that wasn't used. So they had gone through the whole stack of scripts and they had cherry picked stuff. It was proof that they were using our writing in their show. And at that point, the arbitrator found in our favor and we got a huge settlement and we established a precedent. So from now on, you know, Writers Guild writers are paid a minimum for the theme park exploitation of their
So the Simpsons creators, the E.T. writer, the Fast and Furious writers, all those guys get something now from all those rights.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And out of curiosity, like, and I'm not going to ask numbers, but like, how do you, is it a percentage of, like, how do you get a residual off of a show that is based off of an entry price? There's no charging for the show. How does that work?
Yeah. So that was difficult to figure out.
Right.
You're right. It's a turnstile. You're paying, right. I don't know what it's.
For all of it. Yeah. You're paying Harry Potter, for Transformers, everything.
So how do you assign it to here? So they did a buyout. They did a flat fee for us, and it was substantial. Mm-hmm. And then in the Writers Guild contract, there's a minimum. There's a, you know, whatever it is. I'm not sure what it is. It might is it 75,000? It might be. If your work is turned into a theme park ride, you get a minimum of this. And you can negotiate above scale, but it's a flat fee. It's a buyout, basically.
Okay. So for that 25 years, you're not getting percentages of anything. You just got a big flat out payoff.
Yeah.
Which was substantial. Which is not the minimum.
Correct. And it was for every time they opened it in a new park, we got another payment. So I think that's true in the Writers Guild contract too, which is, you know, you get this payment for one use, and if there's another one, you get another payment, you know, et cetera.
Got it. And whatever. And then, but you have the power to negotiate at that point if they want
it. You negotiate above scale. If your name is Joss Whedon, you're going to get more than that. Yes.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But
Joe Schmo, you're going to get the minimum.
Got it. But something.
Yeah.
It's something. It's something to give you. And you're still getting residual checks off the exploitation of that film.
I am.
That's insane. I mean, 25, you would think a film like that, and Waterworld is such an interesting legacy, because I mean, it's a movie that has still stayed in the zeitgeist. And because there's a lot of movies that was made in that time. Like there was that other really big stinker that Kevin did, which was Postman.
Oh yeah, that's right after. Another post-apocalyptic, another
one. Which is now gaining traction again. People are going back and finding it because everyone's thinking about post-apocalyptic things because of
keeping the post alive. Yes.
Because yeah, exactly. Of us.
And you know, Alex, I was paid the biggest compliment recently. You know, most of the people that I talk to, you know, when they find out that I wrote Waterworld, they go, I love that movie. That thing, you know, got so much fun. Yeah, it was so much fun, blah, blah. You know, but this one kid said to me, I mean, whatever, you know, he's in his 40s or something, but he said to me, that was my eye-opening moment where I started thinking about climate change. Like that movie
made
me think about the oceans, you know, would rise or whatever. And, you know, it was interesting because conceptually, you know, when I write anything sci-fi, when I create worlds or whatever, I always like to have, you know, ontological authenticity, like to the extent that I can, I like things to make sense, like to really, you know, and ultimately Waterworld, they changed so many things that didn't make sense. But anyway, but I think that every movie gets one leap of faith. Like once you get one, like here's your gimme. Okay. And in the case of Waterworld, it was the amount that the ocean would rise. In fact, if all the ice were melted on Earth. You know, and I remember researching at the time, and it was like, if all the ice were melted, it would be like 35 feet or whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay. In my version, a part that they took out of the movie, which this was the biggest loss, when the Mariner leaves dry land at the very end and goes and sails off, and Helen and Enola are at the top of the mountain, they watch him sailing away. And by the way, that's a Western moment.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the Western in a second, but go ahead.
Okay. they see something underfoot. It's a plaque. They dust it off, and on it says, here in the year, I forgot what the year was, 53, Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay summited this peak. It's Everest. It's Mount Everest.
They took that out.
And
why?
That was the thing that got Kevin Reynolds interested in directing the movie. He said, this is the Planet of the Apes moment. This is the Statue of Liberty. This is
right.
That's yeah. And it got him so excited. But, you know, Kevin Costner did take over the edit, and he decided to excise that moment. And I understand that choice also, because there's this sort of emotional thing that's happening between, you know, the girl who's, you know, seeing the Mariner sail off, and you kind of maybe want to stay in that part space and not add a gimmick onto it. So I get it, but for me, that was like, yeah, it was a nice moment, you know.
Yeah. So, okay. So how is, because you said that before, how is Waterworld a Western?
Well, so there's two parts to the writing process for me. First is the concept, you know, what's that idea that really lights you up and says, oh my God, I can't wait to sink my teeth into it. So Mad Max on Water, that was the idea there. But then the other one, and this is the much more devilish one, is what's the structure? What's the three acts? What's the story? You know, and you know, when you're writing something on water, that's really challenging. Like, you know, there's no geography. Like, where you go from point A to point B, what's point A and what's point B? Like, you got to make all that stuff up. And, you know, is it, it's a boat floating over here? Then how does it make sense? And is it a coincidence? And there's lots of stuff that you got to think about. And another breakthrough for me was I suddenly remembered the movie Shane.
Yeah.
Remember Shane?
Of course.
Okay. Shane.
Yeah.
Homesteaders are trying to live peacefully on, you know, the Wild West, and you got your bad guys, your pirates who want to take advantage of them. And here comes that, you know, lone cowboy with a dark past that you don't want to talk about, you don't want to ask questions about. Okay. He rides into town, Shane. You know, he walks into that bar. You can tell he's killed a lot of guys, and the bad guys mess with him, and he decides to take side with the homesteaders. He spends off the pirates, and then he rides away. That's the structure of Waterworld. It's a Western.
Shane has been stolen so many times as far as structure is concerned. I mean, from – I think Joe Esterhaus did it for Nowhere to Run with Jean-Claude Van Damme. I remember that was Shane. Logan, as more recent – as they literally put Shane in the movie. Like, Logan's watching Shane. They're like – wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It's Shane, guys, but it's with a mutant. Shane is such an amazing – that structure of – that idea of that character of being this – the lone wolf who has a dark past, but yet he comes back. He comes back towards the light by doing good, even though he might have killed God knows how many people in his past. Mm-hmm. It's such a powerful character. Why do you think that is? Why does that resonate so wonderfully with the audiences?
You know, and I teach writing. My wife and I do a creative workshop, and one of the things that we talk about is the fall from grace moment. All stories, it's part of the human condition, fall from grace. I mean, you know, the Garden of Eden, even your birth is a fall from grace in some ways. You know, mm-hmm. You were in the womb, it was all glorious. And yeah,
it was all good. We were warm, fed, everything was good. We had, like, people loved us inside, like his mom loved us.
So the question is, you know, this is a really good exercise for writers, is think about the fall from grace for your principal character. It's where is it going to be in the movie structure, and what is the tone of the fall from grace? So for instance, in a broad comedy, like a Jim Carrey movie, that fall from grace is front and center. It's in the first 10 minutes, and it's highly humiliating. It's like, oh my God, here I am with my pants down in a court of law or whatever. You know, it's one of those moments, or Ben Stiller moments. It's a broad slapstick fall from grace, right? In film noir, or in sort of a darker, edgier movie, the fall from grace happens in the distant past, and it is never discussed. It's something that's not talked about. It's like the buried child from the Sam Shepard play. It's that thing that it's Chinatown. Chinatown is Jake had a fall from grace in Chinatown. It's never discussed. And it haunts the movie. So that energy of that character, why is he so mean? Why is he so shut down? Why is he a loner? Well, he obviously has some stuff from his past that he doesn't want to talk about. In various drafts, we wrote those scenes, like the murder of his family and stuff like that. We just decided to take them out. It's much more interesting to not be discussed. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, because your imagination builds something else up. So that was the whole thing with Obi-Wan Kenobi and Star Wars, like this older Jedi, like, and he would just talk about certain things like the Clone Wars. And I had a student who killed your father. And then it turns out to be Darth Vader. Sorry. Spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen Star Wars. But that character was so powerful and had so much weight behind him purely because of like all this stuff. And they even talked about it gossiping,
like, oh, you don't want to go see Ben Kenobi? No, no, don't, no. It was so, it was really interesting. But you're right. That kind of, it's a very powerful character, a tool for your character is if you have this backstory, specifically A Fall from Grace is extremely powerful depending on your story, that drives the current narrative, like in Waterworld. So Peter, I wanted to thank you for coming on and being as raw and honest about Waterworld and your experience with Waterworld as you have been, because it is, I mean, again, for my generation, I just know how much of a beating that film took. And I just love knowing, because I even said that during myself, like I was sitting there watching Waterworld, the show at Universal. And I'm like, how can this be such a big flop if it's still here? Like this thing is still going, you know, and what I've discovered now talking to you, it that there is something about the concept of Waterworld, which Mad Max has a longevity as well. Just the concept of Mad Max, the post-apocalyptic, everything's gone. You got to find gasoline and water and all that stuff. But Waterworld takes that and kind of amplifies it, because now you throw in the flood myth, which mm-hmm. then everybody on the planet knows the flood myth. It's like you said, in their DNA. And then you have the ecological aspect of it, like, oh, global warming and all that stuff. So it's hitting on so many cylinders, and it's honestly very ahead of its time, because in the mid-90s, or when you thought about it, which was in the mid-80s, climate change wasn't a thing really at that point. It was talked about, but very, very minimally. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting how it is grown, and it continues to grow. It's the popularity of the concept. By the way, why hasn't Universal done a sequel, a reboot, something else? Or are they just scared to death of it? Because you can make that film much more affordably now.
Yeah, yeah. This is an excellent question, and I'm actually restricted in what I can say about it.
Nice.
but yes, there's lots of complicated machinations behind what's going on right now with the rebooting Waterworld.
With the brand, because yeah. Universal in general doesn't have Marvel, doesn't have DC. They don't have like a 3,000 characters. They don't have Harry Potter. They don't have Star Wars. So they have Fast and Furious, which they are definitely exploiting without, and they have a handful of IP and brands, but they don't have a lot of like IP. Like Waterworld could be a thing. Like you could do a three picture deal.
The thing is, they are rolling out sequels in the form of theme parks. So in other words, this idea right. that, you know, that's the safe way of exploiting that IP is just do another theme park. You know, we know exactly how much that's going to cost. We can totally contain that. And let's just do it in China. We'll do a whole zone, you know.
But they're a little bit gun shy, because they're like, ooh, that first one went to $175 million. We were only expecting to spend 60. We can't take a $300 or $400 million hit. So I guess it has to be the filmmaker behind it, what to do and where to go. But I know, like, I've spoken to the guy who created Final Destination and that horror series. He goes, every time they make one, he gets a check. I met the guy who wrote Fast and Furious, and he's like, he hasn't written a Fast and Furious in a long time, but every time they make one, he gets a check. So I'm praying for you, sir, that they make 20 more of those films.
Thank you.
Now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. What are three screenplays every screenwriter should read?
Uh-huh. I think Tootsie is brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
And mostly in the way there's so many subplots and they're so well integrated, you know, these incredible things that all have payoffs and they all come to a culminating head in that one moment where Michael Dorsey rips off his wig. You know, it's just brilliant the way that's structured. Not that I'm a comedic writer, but that is a brilliant script. What else do I love? I love Peter Weir's Picnic at Hanging Rock mm-hmm. for how minimalist it is and how he never reveals what happened on that rock. You know, just that kind of brooding, quiet, patient, you know, sort of teasing out about just basically a brooding mood. You know, it's a lot of that's in the filmmaking, but I think it's in the script also. And what else? When am I going to go for a third one? I'll go to something indie, like Do the Right Thing.
Which wasn't indie. I mean, that was a Universal release, but it was low budget and definitely not not Waterworld budget level. Though it would be very interesting to see Do the Right Thing on water. No, that film. I mean, people went back every year to a Spike Lee movie in hopes of getting the same feeling they got when they saw Do the Right Thing. It was just, it's a masterpiece. Now, what advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
Writing is a discipline, and it should not be results driven. So fall in love with process. You are a writer if you show up on a regular schedule at your computer for a given amount of time, and it doesn't matter how much you produce, as long as you're sincere. You stand there, you look at that blank page, and you clock in, you clock out, you're a writer. Don't fall in love with the highs and don't sink the lows. The middle path, just stay committed to process. That's long-term success in this business is all about the willingness to take ego death, to take the spear in the heart and just let it go, move on, resurrect, get back in the saddle and type another sentence.
What did you learn from your biggest failure?
Same thing, resilience. Being willing to just do it again. It's not about the results. And it's so tempting to get wrapped up in the results, especially the successes. Those are really insidious. It's like, oh my God.
It's like a drug. You get that high, and especially if you associate yourself with that high and associate your work with that high, that you need that every time, if you're done. Because nobody in our industry is at the top all the time. Like, not everyone hits home runs every time.
And I'm going to say one other thing, which is I did have a period of writer's block that was pretty intense. It's like three months or so. I think every writer does, and so it's interesting to talk about it. But I have a metaphor that I like to introduce, which is the intersection of indecision. There is a temptation to stay in the intersection of indecision, which means you kind of stare at the screen and you think and you scratch your chin and you make your cappuccino and you think and you blah, blah, blah. And you're sitting in that intersection, not making a choice. You got to make a choice. Get out of that freaking intersection as quickly as you can and write the shitty sentence. And here's the other metaphor, which is back in the old day when pipe was made out of, you know, whatever, not copper, but where, you know, you were out of town for a few months, you ran your bath, the water came out, it was brown, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, iron.
Iron pipes, brown water. Okay. Mm-hmm. When you ran that brown water, did you go into a tailspin? Did you panic? Did you call the plumber? Were you like, oh my God, what's going on? Is this the apocalypse? No, it was simply brown water. What comes after brown water? Clear water. Be willing to write the brown sentence. Write the shitty sentence. Write the brown water, and the other stuff comes. The flow begins. Get out of the intersection. Fall in love with process. Write the brown sentence, and that's what you do.
I love write the brown sentence. That's a great. That should be a T-shirt. Now, where can people find you and the new work that you're doing with your company?
So my website is peterrader.com. And our production company is thisiscounterpointfilms.com. thisiscounterpointfilms.com, where we're doing all sorts of cool things.
And if you guys haven't seen Awake, the Paramahansa Yogananda story, if you guys have listened to me for a while, you know that it's one of my favorite documentaries of all time. You should definitely watch that. And I know they have a ton of other good stuff that they're doing over there at Counterpoint Films. Peter, again, thank you so much for being on the show. I truly, truly appreciate your time and your candor with the amazing, now a very profitable Waterworld. So thank you again, my friend.
Thanks, Alex. It was really fun.
I want to really thank Peter for coming on the show and being so raw and vulnerable and honest about his experience writing and being part of Waterworld, considered one of the biggest flops of all time. But as you now know, It is not. It is not all what they say it was. That film has done an insane amount of business and continues to do an insane amount of business. And we will see what Universal Studios will do with the IP if they decide to reboot it and what they plan to do with it. I'd be interesting to see an updated version of Waterworld with today's technology and see what actually could be done with it in the right hands. So I'm really, really curious about that. But thank you again, Peter, for coming on the show. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, and if you haven't seen it, if you want to watch Waterworld, just head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/085. And I also want to let you know, guys, that I am teaming up with John Truby, the legendary story master and author of the best-selling book, The Anatomy of Story. And we are going to bring you a free webinar training called Stories That Sell. And John will explain his system to help you structure and layer genres, characters, story worlds, themes, and everything else within the individual screenplay. Now, if you want access to this free webinar, just head over to truby.com/hustle. That's Truby, truby.com/hustle. Thank you again for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Screenwriter's Mind at screenwritersmind.com.